ॐ भरताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वाम् अनुसन्ततामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणी. We're actually on verse 12, but let's, while we start chanting from verse 11 for a while, okay? Since that's the first verse of the Gita, in terms of Krishna getting the teaching. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. श्री भगवान् उवाच अशोचान् अन्वशोचस्त्वम् अशोचान् अन्वशोचस्त्वम् प्रज्ञावादांश्च भाषसे प्रज्ञावादांश्च भाषसे कथासून् अकथासूंश्च कथासून् अकथासूंश्च नानुशोचन्ति पण्डिताः नानुशोचन्ति पण्डिताः नत्वेवाहं जातु नासं नत्वेवाहं जातु नासं नत्वं नेमे जनाधिपाः नत्वं नेमे जनाधिपाः न चैव न पविष्यामः न चैव न पविष्यामः सर्वे वयमतः परम् Sarve vayamata param. Sandhi. Na tu eva aham jatu na asam na tvam na ime janadhipaha. Na cha eva na bhavishyamaha sarve vayam ataha param. Remember in verse 11, Bhagavan says, that really the first verse, the beginning of the teaching, where Bhagavan says to Arjuna, hey Arjuna, You are grieving for those that need not be grieved for. You're grieving for that which shouldn't be grieved for. Asochan anvasochaha tvam. You're grieving for that which does not deserve any grief. And at the same time, you're speaking words of wisdom, because he's talking so much about dharma and adharma and proper behavior. So you're speaking words of wisdom, and then at the same time, you're grieving for things that don't deserve grief, which means that your wisdom is incomplete, right? There's wisdom there, but it's incomplete. You don't have a vision of the whole. Then he says, "Panditaha," the pundits, those who have a knowledge of the self as I am the whole. That knowledge of the self means your knowledge is complete. You have a knowledge of the self. Knowledge of Atma means that you understand subject and object. Not just this world within the samsara, the world within maya, that a proper behavior for the jiva. What is proper behavior for the jiva? What happens to the jiva after death? All of these type of things. What is proper behavior? What is dharma and adharma? This, your knowledge is clear. But you don't have a knowledge of the reality. What is the nature of the self, the one who is the whole? That you don't know. So you're speaking of the words of wisdom. Really, from the Karmakanda, from the first part of the Vedas, you're speaking words of wisdom, but you don't have knowledge of the self. Pundits, the panditas, those who have self-knowledge, they na anusochanti, they don't grieve for those for whom the breath has gone, nor for those who still have their breath. They don't grieve for the living or for the dead. Okay, so that was Lord Krishna's introduction. It's his first, it's like the pratigna. It's the first verse, the first statement, which now he has to give the reasons for all of that. So here, Shankara introduces there's always in these verses, you know, there's the verse, and then there's a commentary. The commentary will always have some sort of what we call a sangati, a link. You know, what's the relationship between this verse 11 and verse 12? You know, what links them? So there'll always be a little statement that Shankara makes to make that connection. And Swamiji in his Swamiji also in his Bhasha, which you know the Gita home study, he will also always work on making these connections. Why does Krishna go from point A to point B here? And so here Shankara says the question that Arjuna would have in his mind, why don't they deserve grief? Why shouldn't they be grieved for? They're all going to die. Don't people who are going to die deserve grief? If I'm going to die, shouldn't I be sorrowful for that? If my family's going to die, doesn't that deserve grief? How can you say that? So he says, kutaha te asoshaha, means why? What is the reason that they're not deserving of grief? He says, yataha nityaha, because they're free from time, because they're immortal. They're not going to die. That's why. There's nothing to grieve for. If you're grieving for because these people are going to die, that isn't true. And so you're grieving for what doesn't deserve any grief, because you're projecting that something is going to happen, which is actually not going to happen at all. So this is Krishna's next verse. He says, his next part of this teaching, he says, natu eva aham jatu nasam. This is very kind of twisted. It's very beautiful. He says, indeed, I never, na jatu means I never. Okay, tu means, tu eva means, this is, the tu is just it sets things apart. So we don't really translate, you can translate it just as, you don't translate it in English very well. So you would say, na eva aham jatu. He says, I never, na asam. I never not was. I have, and it's a double negative. Sorry, I've got a little allergy. I've got to keep this. I hope you can all stand this. Cool. Okay. I have never not been. Not to eva jatu nasam. I have never not been. You see the double negative? I have never not been. Not to, nor you, not tuam, nor you. You also have never not been. Okay. Na ime jana dipaha, nor also these kings, all of these people, all of these rulers of the people, all the rulers of the, all of these kings, all of these people, you know, all of these teachers and all of these people who are rulers among men, jana dipaha, the rulers of the people, all of these people. They also have never not been. So here Krishna says, and then Krishna is kind of understood as an avatar. So you can say, well, of course, Krishna is an avatar. Of course, he's always been, right? But then Krishna doesn't stop there. He says, you also have never not been. Means you also have always been. And then I just go, well, I also have, you have never not, the Lord has never not been, I also have never not been. What about everybody else? They also have never not been. Everybody has always been. Everybody has always been. Then he says, then Arjuna can think, okay, so we've always been, but all of these people now are going to die. So they've never not been, but what about in the future? So the Lord says, na cha eva na bhavishyamaha, and we will never not be future. Another double negative. Na cha eva na, so na na, bhavishyamah, and we will never not be. Who? Sarve vayam. Vayam means we. Sarve means all. All of us. All of us. In English, we say, and none of us will never not be. Right? I never was not. You never were not. All of these kings never were not. And all of us will never not be. Okay? Then he says, atah param. After death. Right? Atah param, it's a statement. Param means after, from this. After this. Means after this life. Right? After, from this, literally. So after this. Okay? We will never not be. Okay? So this is his first introduction. Why do these people not deserve any grief? These living and the dead. Sorry, we're having a manage. Are you okay? Okay. Some of us have allergy to scents, so we'll do our best. Nobody can wear any kind of scents in here. Any perfumes, nothing like that. Hair stuff, you can't have any hair stuff. You know, come in your white. come in your hospital gowns. And all will be well. Okay. So, natu eva aham jatu nasan tun neme janadipaha. Okay, so anyway. Krishna says something interesting here. Listen to what he says, and what Krishna says. He says, I have not been, you have not been, never not been, they have never not been. Okay? So there's an I, there's a you, and there's a they. That's plural, right? So none of us have never not been. And then he says, and all of us, right? Sarve vayam, and all of us will never not be. Plural. So now, Shankara is worried. You know, are you going to think that there are many Atmas? That each of us has an Atma, right? Each of us has an Atma that is eternal. You have an eternal Atma. I have an eternal Atma. Krishna has an eternal Atma. We all have eternal Atmas. Because they're using the plural. If I say to you, just in language, all of us will always be. All of us always have been, and all of us will always be. That's in the plural. So does that mean that there are many Atmas? Because he's using the plural. We all will always be. So Shankara says like this. He says, and Swamiji quotes this in his Bhasha, because it's a very important point. It says, Deha Beda Anuvritya Bahuvachanam Na Atma Beda Abhiprayena. He says, conforming only to the difference in the bodies, taking into account the different bodies, the upadis, right? We use the bahuvachanam. We use the plural here. He says, na atma beda abhiprayena. It's not for the intent of showing different atmas. So look, from the standpoint of the upadis, the conditioning adjuncts, you know, there's 10 of us in the room. And there are 10, 12, whatever, upadis, 12 bodies in the room. Right. But each one of these, and for Arjuna, there's Arjuna and Krishna and all of the kings and all of the soldiers and all of these people, right, in the Kurukshetra there. So many of them. But you could never say all of these bodies all have been, and all of these bodies always will be. You can't say that. It makes no sense. Because every body, every upadi by its nature, is subject to change. And so when Krishna is saying, you know, all of us have never not been and will never not be, he cannot be referring to the physical body. Because the physical body is something which by nature is bound by death. So this is one of those statements where in order to make sense of the statement, you have to drop off of the statement that which is not true. Right? So look, if I say You know, I don't die. I have always been and I always will be. If I make that statement, then I have to take off of the word I all of the things that are subject to death. I can't mean that. Okay? And what it also means is that who I am, the one that doesn't die, if I am the one who doesn't die, I cannot be that which dies. It's almost black and white, like this. If I do not die and my body dies, I cannot be my body. Because the body is born and dies. Right? So there's this, so if I make a statement like that, you can say, well, your mind can say, this is not true because the body dies. Or you can say, what do you mean? What do you mean? Now, this is the same in the Mahavakya. In the Mahavakya, when you say Tat Tvamasi, that thou art, you are Ishwara, you the Jiva. If I take the Tat Tvamasi to mean you, the Tvam to mean you, and Tat to mean Ishwara, the whole, you are the whole, you are Ishwara, I can just say, well, that's not true, I'm not Ishwara, because this body and mind and sense organs are limited. So how can I be, even in any way, equate myself with the Lord that we consider to be the creator and omniscient and omnipotent and all of these things? How could that possibly be true? And so these Upanishads are just the tribal babblings, as what's his name, that Max Mueller said. It's just infantile babblings. Because, I mean, obviously this isn't true. Obviously this isn't true. So when a statement like this is made, you know, I always have been, you always have been, we all always have been, then for Arjuna, the question is going to be, if he has Shraddha, because he's approached Krishna as his teacher, right? How is that? How is it that, who is it, how is it, and who is it that has never not been and who always will be? Because, now look at it like this. From the standpoint of this physical body for all of us will come into being and go out of being. That's a given. And so the self that you're talking about as me now has to be distinct from that. So is Krishna talking about the transmigrating jiva, right, the soul? Because in Hinduism, you know, in the East, transmigration of the soul also is understood. So Arjuna could say, well, yeah, that's right, because we all, you know, we'll just take another body and life will go on. Okay? But really, so it could mean that, and then if that is meant, if you take it on that level, where you're talking just about the transmigrating jiva, then Krishna is telling him something that's very practical. You know, life goes on. You're not this body. Life goes on. Just because, you know, if it's dharma and adharma, you will continue to take bodies. And life goes on. You're not this physical body. You know, so you always have been. You've been taking one body after another body after another body according to your karma. And you'll keep on taking bodies. And so will they, and so will I. The only problem with that is that in the tradition also, when the jiva gains liberation, right? When the jiva gains liberation, there is no more transmigration. There is no more taking of bodies. You just are the whole. And what Krishna is saying here, you know, there's never a time when you have not been, and there's never a time when you will not be. So who is he really referring to? Is yourself as the Atma. Right? You can look at it on one level as a transmigrating jiva, But even that transmigrating jiva, which is a product of ignorance and which exists within duality, really the self of the transmigrating jiva is only the Atma, is only the self. And it is really only yourself that you can say it always has been and always will be. It never goes through any modification whatsoever. And that self, which I am, is the self which you are. And so here now, in this teaching, with this verse, Krishna is referring to the Atma, which is free from time. Right? It's free from time. Because something that has never not been, so just to let your mind grasp this, something that has never not been can't be born. Do you see that? If something has never not been, it can't be born. Because it's already there. So there's no birth for that. And something that will never not be, right, can't have a death. So there is no birth and there's no death, right? There's no becoming and there's no ending. And so that means this thing is something which is free from change because it hasn't come into being. Everything that we experience within the creation comes into being from a prior condition. I just think about it. Every single thing that goes through a modification has come into being from previous thing. If we just use, like, for instance, the clay pot, if I have a lump of clay and I bring the pot into being, the pot has come into being from the lump. And now I change the pot into a plate. And now the plate has come into being. But all of these things come into being. But if the pot comes into being, it's come into being, and then I squash it into a plate. The pot goes out of being, right? And the plate comes into being. Right? Anything that changes is the death, actually, literally, the death of the prior condition. The prior thing is not there. For that which changes, the prior thing is no longer there. Right? And so if you go through any you, your being, goes through any modification at all, that thing which has gone through a modification no longer exists. And so yourself doesn't go through a process of modification. It doesn't come into being at any point in time. It doesn't come into being. And at any point of time, it doesn't go out of being. So that means that the Atma itself is timeless, right? So when that's what Krishna means. You have never not been. Now when he says that, just really think about this, because there's so many little tricks our mind can do with this. If I look at you now and I say, you, the one who is here now, you have never not been. I'm not talking about anybody else. I'm talking about you. You have never not been, and you, the one who is here right now, you will never not be. Right? So what we're talking about is the person who is abiding here right now as the conscious being that I may misidentify with the body. I may misidentify with the sense organs or the mind or with all of these changing experiences that I have. There may be an adyasa, a superimposition upon these things that cause me to take myself to be these changing phenomena that actually do come into being and go out of being. But in fact, even in my experience, I never come into being and go out of being. The situations that I misappropriate or that I falsely identify with come into being and go out of being. This body comes into being and goes out of being. A thought comes into being and goes out of being. An emotion comes into being and goes out of being. Perception comes into being and goes out of being. A certain stage of life comes into being and goes out of being. Right? Every experience that I have comes into being and goes out of being, except for me, the one who is present to all of those experiences. That one never comes into being or goes out of being. That one has never not been and will never not be. That one doesn't deserve any grief. Right? That one, who you are, doesn't deserve any grief because you're fine. Nothing happens. There is no death. You will never experience death. I will never experience death. All of these people will never experience death. There is no such thing as the experience of death. Imagine, now just imagine if you had were having a lucid dream and you were the teacher, right? And you had a classroom in the lucid dream. You know, a bunch of mumukshis came to your class. And you happen to know what's going on. Nobody else does. Right? And you have to make them all realize that there's no such thing as death. In fact, when the whole dream universe just goes away and poof, everybody's gone, nothing will have happened. You won't have the slightest flicker of any loss, of any change in your being. Nothing whatsoever will happen. The death that you fear simply does not exist. And so there is no room for any grief because nothing happens to you or you or you or them. The I, you, them, the I, you, they, that's all only from the standpoint of the upadis that are feeling. All feeling, I'm going to die, or you're going to die, and all of this is a great tragedy. You know, all of this is a terrible tragedy. Where in fact, in reality, nothing is happening. And when you think of this on a cosmic level, the dream is so incredibly for this because think in a cosmic level that. All of the conflagration of the end times, of the earth going through so many problems and huge fires and volcanoes and people dying and animals dying, and just from within the time space of that situation, experiencing it, it's hell. It's a nightmare. So from within the dream, right? It's a very scary, it's very violent, it's a horrific, you know. But from the standpoint of your being, from the standpoint of the whole, in the presence or absence of that universe, whether it's in a state of conflagration, or if it's in a state of like in Swargaloka, or a state, and you know, instead of Kali Yuga, it's in the first, it's in the Satya Yuga, you know. Where everything is so beautiful and fresh. And if you look at the creation as something which is cyclical, they say when the creation first comes, you know, in that cyclical going through all of the yugas, when it first comes, it's so bright and clean and fresh. And the cow, it's like for Brahmaji, at 4 in the morning, when just everything is bright and waking up and everything's, you know, sattvic. It's sattvic and pure, and the cow of Dharma is on four legs. And everything is wonderful. You know, ananda, the mind, because of the Dharma, the mind has a natural equipoise. You know, the clouds and the sky are beautiful. All of the clear, clean waters. Beautiful, beautiful world. End of Kali Yuga. Conflagration. Of just a mix. There is no real container for Dharma, right? Everything is just mixed all together. Yeah. And there's great despair and great unhappiness. But from the standpoint of the one from whom this creation has come, right, and into whom this creation resolves, there is nothing happening. Right? There is nothing happening. Just like when you wake up from a dream, you know, if you wake up from a really wonderful dream, you'll think, oh shoot, you know, oh, I wish I could go back into that, and you try to close your eyes. Have you ever done that where you just go, well, let me close my eyes and see if I can get back into that beautiful dream? And then have you ever had one of those terrible, awful dreams that were so real, they seemed so real, and then you wake up, and then you look around and think, oh my God, that was just a dream. Thank God. Yeah. But the reality is that no matter what it was that was happening, from within the reality of that mithya, from within the reality of that dream world, or from within the reality of this creation, there is so much going on. But your being remains untouched. Because for you, for the conscious you, the one who is here now, for you there, you are not an object within the creation. You are not objectifiable. You are the very conscious being from which, in fact, all of this comes. And that conscious being is not bound by time. It is nitya, right? It is free from time. So you, the one who is sitting here right now, because Krishna is talking right to Arjuna, I was never born, and you were never born. I was never born, I never was not, you never were not. And I never will not be, you never will not be, they never will not be. For your being, there is no modification, no change whatsoever. And so then, he continues on with an example. Because anytime you have an initial pratigna, an initial statement, you give some unfoldment as to what you mean by it, which he did. You know, there's no cause for grief because you don't die. You're grieving over these people all being died, this kind of holocaust that's going to happen. You're grieving over that. You're grieving over the death of all of these people. Nobody dies. Nobody goes through any modification whatsoever. And then the next question would be, Shankara asked, he says, Tatra katam eva nityaha atma. He says, how is the self eternal? What, can you give me an example? What is that like? What do you mean? How is the self, you know, how is it that the self is never born or dies? Give me an example. So here Krishna gives him an example. He says, Dehinosmin yata dehe. Dehinosmin yata dehe. Kaumaram yavanam jara. Kaumaram yavanam jara. Tatha dehantara praptihi. Tatha dehantara praptihi. Dhiras tatra namuhyati. Dhiras tatra namuhyati. Sandeep. Dehinaha asmin yatha. Dehe kalmadam yavanam jara tata deha antara praptihi diraha tatra na muhyati. Okay. He says dehinaha. For the dehi, dehi comes from the substantive, the noun dehin, right? These in-ending nouns, which Sanskrit students haven't learned the in-ending nouns yet, but the in-ending nouns are coming. In the Sanskrit class, yeah. Yeah, Saturday morning Sanskrit class. Yeah. So these in-ending nouns, I-N, okay, they show possession. So here, the deha, it's an a-ending masculine noun, it means the physical body, the deha. The dehin is the one who has a physical body. So there's a lot of words that will end in in that will show possession, you know, of whatever it is. So deha is body, dehin is the one who has the body. So we can say the indweller of the body or the one who possesses the body. Okay. So dehinaha is in the genitive singular, dehinaha. So us men, means so for the indweller of the body, us men is locative singular, in this, yata, just as, dehe, locative singular, so us men dehe, just as in this body, us men dehe, yata, just as, us men dehe, in this body, kaumatam, childhood, yavanam, youth, jara, old age. Okay? Kaumatam, yavanam, jara, old age. For Sanskrit students, if you notice the vriddhi in the kaumatam, comes from kumaram, kumara, kumara. Yavanam comes from yuvanam. And jara just means old age. This is the abstract, the state of being a youth, the state of being a child, childhood, the state of being a youth, you know, what's the word for that?
Adolescent.
An adolescent. And then jara just means old age, okay? So here, in this body, just as there is childhood, adolescence, and old age for the indweller of the body, okay, for the dehin. Tata, similarly, deha antara praptihi, there is the prapti, is a compound, deha body, deha antara, another body, praptihi, the attainment, the taking, the gain of another body. Dhiraha, the wise one, the one who has this viveka, the one who has this knowledge, the dhiraha, the one who has this knowledge, tetra there, in regards to that, na muhyati, is not confused, is not deluded. Okay? So here's the example. Just as in life, a person goes through these states. First you're a child, then you're a teenager, then you become old. You go through a series of experiences in life, or stages. And when you become an adolescent, that stage of life replaces the childhood stage, right? When the one is, the other is not. And when the old age comes, you lose your youth, right? So when the one is, the other is not. So these states replace one another. But the indweller, the self, who is the self of the child, the self of the infant, the self of the child, the self of the adolescent, the self of the adult, the self of the elder, that person doesn't change at all. These states go on changing, replacing. One state replaces the next, replaces the next, replaces the next. But I remain the same. So the one who is the child is the one who is the adult, is the one who is the elder. So like that, this replacement of this physical body also, when this body dies, it is replaced by another body. And I, the one who is now enjoying this state of experience with this physical body, I will enjoy this next state of experience with this next physical body. Right? So just as... And this is something to really kind of understand the logic, the extension. There's an extension, there's what we call a logical extension taking place here. It's a teaching, and this teaching is what the Shastra says. It's what you find in the Shruti or the Upanishads. So this is the teaching of the Upanishads. But you also, there's a logic here to be understood. And that... And what we call an extension. In other words, in my experience here, there's a logic that's called anvaya vyatireka. Okay? Anvaya vyatireka. The anvaya goes like this. When this is, that is. It shows that there's a concordance, there's a relationship. When this thing is, that thing is. That's the anvaya. The vyatireka is the opposite. When this is not, that is not. Right? And so now, if something has a real relationship of one thing with the other, if there's a true connection, I can say that anvaya vyatireka will apply. I will be able to say, When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. And I use that as a proof to show that there's a relationship between the two. They can't be separated. If you get rid of one, you get rid of the other. And one example they use is, if a day is, if the sun is, the day is. If the sun is not, the day is not. The daylight, this daylight is dependent on that sun. The sun goes around, you know, the earth goes, it shifts. The sun is not present, the day is gone. So day and sun have a relationship there. So now, in your experience, you need to be able to apply this anvaya vyatireka in order to discover who you are. Because just in terms of the totality of your experience at this moment, right? There's things where you can, there, most of, almost everything in your experience would go like this. When I am, when this is, I am. Okay, let's do it like that. When this is, I am. When this experience is, I am. Like right now. Here I'm having this experience through my sense organs, and I am. When this is, I am. Right? But when the class is over, and all of you go away, this experience no longer is, but I still am. And so, my being is not dependent on the on this experience. If this experience can come and go and nothing happens to me, I remain. What if I could say, well, when this experience is, I am. When this experience is not, I am not. Then there's a dependence. There's a relationship. And so then I become, I must have that experience or I no longer exist. Okay, so now, that's very silly in reference to experiences that are gained out external to the body that are gained through my sense organs. I can always say, you know, when this is, I am, when this is not, I am. And so therefore, I'm free of the experience. It can come and go and I remain. That's basically what I'm saying. But now, what about when you apply that to your relationship with your with the experiences? Let me put it like this. With the experiences that you have in reference to your physical body, in reference to your mind, in reference to your thoughts, in reference to your emotions, in reference to everything, in fact, that you, I would say, misidentify with. If something is intrinsically you, you have to be able to say, when this is, I am. When this is not, I am not. And what you end up with, you know, is nothing will fit into that criteria. Nothing. Because everything in your experience, except yourself, is negatable. And so it will always end up with, when this is, I am, when this is not, I still am. No matter what it is, this is what it's going to turn out to be. When this experience is, I am. When this experience is not, I still am. So now the question is going to be, so just try to imagine this. If I say, when this experience is, whatever it is, whether it's you're referring to a thought or a perception of your physical body or an emotion or whatever, when this is, I am. Now you have to, okay, that means what you're really saying is yes, I am having this emotion. I'm present to this emotion. I'm aware of this emotion. I am here, and so is this emotion. I am here, and so is this perception. Right? That's what we're saying. Now, but then I would say, when this experience, this emotion is here, I am. And when this emotion is gone, I still am. Right? Now, what does that mean? There's somebody who hasn't gone. The emotion has gone. The perception has gone. I have not gone. Who is that? What is that one like? Who is the one, the you, that hasn't gone? And this can be applied to absolutely every experience that you have. Sometimes, like I can say, be aware right now of your big toe. you know, your right big toe. I'm sure you weren't aware of it before. So now I'm, unless that would be weird, wouldn't it? Oh, somebody says, no, I was just, I was aware of my, okay, your left little toe. Okay, so as soon as I say that, then that comes into your consciousness, right? But you weren't aware of that before. You were present, but you were not present with that experience. You were present, but not with that experience. That means that you can be without that experience. What is it that always is that you can never be without? Where you say, I always am. When this is, I am. When this is, I am. When this is, I am. When this is not, I am. When this is not, I am. You get to that place where I just am. I can't get rid of myself. And you get into that kind of that biblical thing, I am that I am. Right? Because you can't, you can never get behind that or beyond that or get into any type of a condition or experience where your own presence is not there. Right? That's that anvayavyatireka. Okay, so now, in your life, this life that you experience here in the world, through your sense organs and your mind, you notice that there is a anvayavyatireka like that. There's a the absence of the vyatireka. In other words, what that means is this is an I am, and this is not an I still am. I am a child. The childhood goes away, but I still am. I am now an adolescent. The adolescence goes away, but I still am. I am old. Right? The adolescence has gone away, I still am, but now I am old. So in reference to the body, I continue to be as these states negate each other. The states are coming and going, right? And that will continue. If this state is replaced by this state, it's replaced by this state, and I remain exactly the same. That means my experience is not altered at all by the state. I remain the same. When this body dies, if I have no relationship in terms of this anvayavyatireka with the state, then when this body dies, I also will be. It's the same. If you could take to the reference to your mind, I have a mood. I am happy. When happiness is, I am. When happiness is not, and sadness is, I still am. One state is replaced by another state, is replaced by another state, is replaced by another state. I still am. I'm not replaced. So the being that's aware, that illumines these states, is not changed by the states. If I'm not changed by the states, and the states come and go, I am not the state. If I'm not changed by the physical body, and the physical, because I'm aware of the physical body, there's a subject-object relationship. When the physical body comes and goes, I don't come and go. So here, what Krishna is pointing out here is, okay, look, just like you don't change in your youth, but when these states of experience happen in terms of your body, your childhood, and your youth, and your old age, just as when you don't change, as these states change, the one who is a child is the one who is a youth, is the one who is an adult, is the one who takes the next body. And that goes on and on and on. Whatever the experience is, the Atma remains the same, because the Atma is not objectifiable or doesn't have an intrinsic relationship with any of the objects that are being illumined. And all of the objects that are being illumined, this is another thing. In your experience, every object, including the body, your mind, your sense perceptions, every single object that is illumined is changing, and you are aware of its change. Right? Every object, everything we experience in the creation, from the mind to the sense organs, to moods, emotions, the mind, even the eye notion, the ahankara, the world of perception. Everything is changing. That means that you are there before, during, and after its change. If you are there before, during, and after its change, you don't have anything to do with it. Whatever it is not you. Because it comes and goes and you remain. Right here itself. If it comes and goes, if all experience that you have right here itself in this waking state, if all experience that you have right here itself comes and goes and you remain, then you don't have a relationship to it. It's already a fact. It's already a given. It comes and goes and you remain. Therefore, it's not you. Because you're here before, during, and after. It's not you, period. So here, he uses this example. But you can even take it to thinking of this anvayavyati reka in terms of let's look at the whole 24-hour day. It's the same thing. Here you are, you. Here you are in this waking state. The waking state is I am. No problem. Waking state is totally replaced by the dream world. Now the dream experience is here. Waking state is gone. Dream experience is here with a different body, different setting. Waking body is gone. Waking setting is gone. You have a different body, or you may not have a body at all. But still, the dream experience is, it's replaced the waking, but I am. So the I that is there present to the waking state is gone, replaced by the dream state. Right? That I that was there for the waking state, I am there for the dream state. So the waking state is I am. The dream state replaces the waking state, I am. Right? So the waking state is I am, the waking state is not I am. The dream state, which has replaced the waking state, so what that dream state is, I am. Dream state is not I am. Deep sleep state, no waking state, no dream state, I am. Can't say I am not, because when you wake up, even though your mind isn't chattering at the time of the deep sleep, you're not saying, oh, isn't this nice, I'm deep sleeping. You're not saying that because the mind is in it's in resolved condition. It's not thinking. But when you wake up, then the mind describes that situation and says, you know, when I'm asleep, you know, there's no dream going on, there's nothing, I'm just totally with myself, or however you want to say it. You said I have a wonderful sleep or whatever. There's no time that's taking place in deep sleep because the mind is collapsed, so there's no marking of time. But so here, deep sleep is, I am. So, look at who, if you take it on that level, you've got the dream state, you have the waking state, replaced by the dream state, replaced by the deep sleep state, replaced by the waking state, the dream, the deep sleep. I am the anuvritti, I'm the constant. Okay? Who is that? Who is that? Because it's not the dream world, it's not the waking world, it's not the waking body, it's not the waking sense organs, it's not the waking mind, it's not the dream world, it's not the dream body, it's not the dream sense organs, it's not the dream mind, it's not the dream ahankara. Yeah, I know, it's not the waking ahankara either. Because I'm in the waking state, I've taken on this body. In the dream state, I've taken on another body. And both are fine for me. I don't feel anything. There's nothing weird about that. I could even be in an animal body. I could be in no body. I could have a dream and have no body at all, just be identified with the whole thing. It's perfectly normal, perfectly natural. Nothing at all has happened to me. It's fine with me. It's fine, absolutely fine with me to be the whole. It's absolutely fine with me to be identified with a creature, to not be identified with a creature, to change creatures. It makes no difference because in reality, nothing happens to me at all. For my being, there is no coming into being, and there is no going out of being. The self that I am is the self that is present to whatever dress I happen to be wearing. You know, whatever the upadhi is, whatever the dress is, whatever the conditioning is, it is mine. I am the one that fills it. And the one, the I am the one who fills it, that one is not changing. So I don't notice the slightest iota of weirdness. It's like you don't feel funny when you put on this blouse or another blouse. It doesn't make any difference. What difference does it make? You're wearing this dress or you're wearing that dress. Yeah. It's not, your being is not being touched. And so this is how Bhagavan is now attacking this cause for grief. He's now looking at, just now, later we'll go into the sense perception, likes and dislikes. But now he's just saying that there's no cause for grief at all because nobody dies. You can't grieve for for something that isn't there. You can't grieve for something that doesn't happen. The wise, the panditas, the people who know the self, they do not grieve for the living or for the dead. Because for one who knows the self, that phenomena does not exist. And so that grief is not going to take place. And earlier on he talked about the Dharma and Adharma, all of these, and he'll talk about that later also. Even if you look at it from the standpoint of the transmigrating jiva, you know, all of the jivas are taken care of by the Dharma, or by their own karmas in the Dharma of the whole. But here, from the standpoint of the Atma, there is no death. Zero. And so there's nothing to be grieved. The Atma does not deserve. If this is where it ends up, you have to say, the Atma does not deserve grief. The Atma, which is Brahman, certainly does not deserve grief. The Atma, which is in fact the whole, does not deserve grief. There's nothing to grieve. It's very beautiful. So, well, do more next week. Let's just take a minute. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamidachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
No grief for Atma, but it seems to me that there's grief for the upadhi with the upadhis, and the upadhis have grief.
I know, that's why we have to fix them up.
Huh?
The upadhis have grief because of ignorance.
Yeah.
That's why there's bondage and moksha.
But it's natural.
Yeah. The ignorance is natural and beginningless. You know, and so that's why. Say. At some point, you become a mumukshu. Okay. How long did it take you to really kind of a tongue-in-cheek question, because the creation is beginningless. So the number of, you know, lifetimes you've had are beginningless. But at some point in this beginningless number of lifetimes, you think, what's going on?
I thought I became a mamuchu after junior high school. It's not like that.
You became a mamuchu after junior high school in this lifetime. But what about last lifetime? And what about the lifetime before? What about, you know, million lifetimes ago?
Worming its way through this whole...
Worming its way in and out, until finally... It becomes a predominant question. I think that the mamukshutvam skirts around the borders of everybody's consciousness in a way, but not enough to grab you. Not enough to grab you, you know? Because why would you want to think about something like that?
Most people settle. They pick something they settle.
And also the world... The world is so interesting. It solves your problems all of the time itself. Like, for instance, in terms of your own self identity, right now you're the student and I'm the teacher. If I'm attending a class, I become the student. If I go and visit my family, you know, I become the sister. Wherever, if you're talking to a friend, you're the friend. If you're shopping, you're the shopper. Whatever you're doing, you have a place, you know, and you are identified by what you are doing, and you're identified by your role, and you're identified by how you feel. Like, for instance, say you don't feel well. Oh, I'm not feeling well. You're feeling, oh, I feel great, you know. I'm young. I'm old. And so you're always being accounted. You're always have a label for yourself. And then... Also, your experiences of happiness and sadness and agitation and joy are always experienced within a context and are always related to your desire. And so the world, even logically, there's a logic for why you experience the things you do. You know, there's a logic for it. And so it's considered a tremendous punya, you know, actually to have that moment of true self-reflection where you start analyzing your experiences and really want to know, you know, what is going on, and you kind of look up to the Lord and say, if you're really there, please. Or if you have that shraddha in Bhagavan, some people who are really religious will just pray directly, please save me. Help me. What is the truth? Depending on your culture, you know, like some people just know to go to in India, they know to go to their teacher, to go to the guru, because that's what the guru is for. When you become a mumukshu, when you really have this question, then they know they have some place to go. But Bhagavan has to take care of us in a different way.
So what's the logic you were referring to?
Of what? How the logic? The logic of the creation.
Logic.
Yeah,
there.
The logic, like just like this. Here I am. I have five sense organs, and I have this. You know, that kind of keep me connected to the world and to my body, right? And then I have the desire template. I want this so that I can be happy, and I experience over and over again that. If I gain an object that I want, I become happy. And if people stop me from getting the object that I want, I become unhappy. You know?
Like a predictable mechanism.
Oh, yeah. It's predictable. It's predictable, and it works for everybody. But the problem is, and people realize this, but they don't get it at first, you will get the object that you want, and you will become happy. But only for a moment. But your mind then will say, yeah, that's because I need this too. Or that's, you know, you have a reason for it. You have a reason to account for that. Another desire will come, or else you'll realize that you don't feel safe with it. You have to protect it somehow. You know, and that takes away some of the happiness. So then you have something else you have to do. You have to try to protect it or whatever. You always have, your mind is always working to try to make this work, and you do get some benefits. What you do does cause momentary pleasure. Yeah. I mean, it's enough to keep the whole world running until you start questioning it. But that questioning it is not normal. The questioners are the abnormals. The abnorms. You're all abnorms. but instead of the Shruti calling you the abnorms, you know, we're all highly praised. You know, as being something very rare, as being taking great punya. You know, and certain crores and crores and crores of punya and dharma to bring your mind to a state of equipoise enough to have that self-reflection. That's part of the tradition also in any field that you're studying is to praise the student. You know, to give them a value for themselves and for the study. And this deserves that value also.
I just noticed that in this last verse that we were discussing, in the translation, he was a wise person.
The Dira.
Yeah, well, person, I guess I was wondering about the difference between Jiva and Purusha,
because Purusha is very... Well, here they're not talking about the Purusha. Purusha is often used, either it just means a simple man who's walking around in the world. That's just a lay term for Purusha.
Okay.
But Purusha is also often used for the Atma, for Brahman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like Purusha Prakriti.
Right. Which comes from a different direction.
No, but we also use it. In Vedanta, we use it also, Purusha, meaning the Brahman, Ishwara. Yeah, but also, even the word Atma can be used as just, you know, the I am doing such and such. And then the Atma is just referring to the Jiva. Or Atma can be used as the Atma, as the Paramatma. So it's context.
Yeah. That's why you need a teacher then, huh?
Yeah, but also, of course, that is true. But we, in normal language, we ourselves use these words all the time. Like if I say, oh, I'm feeling so unhappy today. I'm talking about my mind. And if I say, you know, I'm going to work out, I'm talking about my body or something. You know, you see what I'm saying? The I is very naturally used in different ways. And that's how language is.
Yeah.
And so we have to be very clear. And in the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras very meticulously look at how each word is being used, because as time goes on, you know, language, you don't know what the idiom is. You know, how that particular word may be being used in that context.
Like, it seems that in this verse, Jiva is basically simply the indweller of the body.
Yes, but who are they talking about? The indweller. Here we're talking about the Atma, the actual Atma, not just the Jiva.
Okay.
And so, yeah, that's why we have to make that clear. Because of the one who is never born and never comes to an end. The one who is nitya, not subject to any time. That's the Atma. In fact, the Jiva is only the Atma, right?
Yeah.
There is no separate Jiva.
Yeah.
But the Jiva is the one who's identified with the Sukshma Sharira that transmigrates.
So, in reference to the body, the term is often used, Jiva.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Transmigrating one is Jivatma.
You can't, I mean, when I read this, because I think of the use of the word Jiva, my first thought was that he's sort of switching from the more absolute level to a more relative level, you know, from the verse 12, he's talking about the Atman, and in the verse 13, he's talking about you know, the jiva in terms of transmigration.
Not really.
No?
Because it, let's just look at this for a minute. In this life itself, this body goes through these straight states of experience. Childhood, youthfulness, and old age. The Atma self, which is Brahman, that's the Atma, not the jiva. But jiva is the Atma, really. Okay, does not go through any modification at all. It's the same when another body is taken. The Atma goes through no modification at all. Mm-hmm. Now, so you're thinking that, oh, they're talking about the transmigrating. They are talking about transmigrating, because when this body drops, the jiva continues to transmigrate. But the Atma doesn't transmigrate, right? The Atma remains the same. Whether the jiva is transmigrating, just like for instance, say you transmigrate from San Francisco to New York. We're not going to use that term, right? But you're traveling, your body is traveling from San Francisco to New York. The Atma, your Atma, is not traveling. Your body is born and it dies. The Atma is not being born and nor does it die. Your body is born, it dies, it takes another body, transmigrates, okay? Your Atma isn't born, it doesn't die, it doesn't take another body. In the sense that it remains, it's not changing. It remains the same. Does that make sense?
Yes, but I guess I still don't know why he used the word jiva then in verse 13 instead of...
I thought he used the word dehi.
Oh, you're right, he does.
Yes.
Oh, that's just in the translation.
Oh, I see. How do they translate it?
He says, just as for the jiva, the indweller of this body, there was childhood, youth, and old age.
They just mean the indweller of the body.
Okay, yeah. That's what's throwing me off. Yeah. You're right, they didn't use the word
dehi. The one who has a body. Dehi means the one who has a body.
So it's the indweller of the body. They don't really even need the word jiva.
You don't need the word jiva. Okay. Yeah. But it's also...
I thought he was being a little compassionate to those of us who aren't quite there yet. But at least you could... Because I was thinking, you know, at least with your... If you think of someone you really love dying.
Yeah.
And if you, you know, if you really contemplate it, and nidhyasana, you can contemplate that, in fact, they don't die, and you're still one. But if you can't quite do that, you know, because it's natural to grieve if someone you love dies, at least you can feel, well, you know, their parabdha karma is taking them where they need to go. But
that's also true. He's not really dealing with that in that verse, but that's implied in the verse also. And he'll deal with that level later. That's absolutely true. When this physical body dies, the subtle body that is taking this physical body right now in order to exhaust experiences, right? This body will die, and that subtle body will take another body. And so say you lose one, a family member or a loved one dies, that one is moving on. And there's a lot of things, there's stories and things that are told, like for that can be very soothing for a person. One is that the time zone between in this realm is much different than for when a person dies. So, for instance, when, say you lose somebody now and you live for another 20 years, from the standpoint of the one who has died, it'll only be like a few minutes. And so often they talk about, you know, there's a reuniting. If the karmas aren't done, you know, those two jivas will reunite and continue on and be reborn together and whatnot. That type of thing is understood. And there's a lot of stories about all of that.
And that's something. It's not like 20 years or past.
Not for the one who died. For us, it's a long time. Right. I say you lose your partner when you're 50, you know. Like sometimes I think about George Burns and Gracie Allen. You know, he lost his beloved Gracie, you know, and
He started his career with her.
Yeah, and he was, maybe he was 70 or so when he lost her, I don't remember, or 60, and he lived to be 100. Yeah, but from her standpoint.
Say goodnight, Gracie.
He was a character. But so anyway, that level is also there. But we're going to the core here.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the transmigrating jiva has an atma, which is you. You, your atma, which is the atma of the transmigrating jiva, that atma never changes. For that atma, there's no birth, there's no death, there's no modification. Whether you're transmigrating, taking another body, or not, or just being in this body, yourself doesn't change. The atma doesn't change. That's the point. So
it's just interesting from a, you know, I actually have the same question. It's interesting from the perspective of looking at that these two experiences simultaneously exist in the person. So there's an understanding, I'm one is the atma, and also the person who just died, who I loved so much, is also only the atma. So really nobody dies, but nobody's ever born. And at the same time, there is a loss, and there is grief. And so how, and there is an emotion called grief that is obviously real. And how do they really work? Because there are really two viewpoints in a certain way that they kind of have to mingle, and into what do they mingle? That is, I mean, that's just an interesting question, really. It's like, where, how does that get resolved inside the pragmatic experience of the human being?
I think that from the standpoint of a jnani, is that, say, somebody who's dear to you dies. There's grief, and there's also a feeling that grief is very beautiful. And it's Ishwara, and it's part of the creation. And also that person deserves that grief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that what is different is there's an appreciation of the grief.
Mm-hmm.
And the grief is taking place in the wholeness of myself. And also there's no build-up on the grief.
Mm-hmm.
There might be an overwhelming grief. You might cry and all of this type of thing. But there's no build-up on the grief. You know, that secondary grief. Why did this happen to me? And what, you know, and all
story.
The... Yeah, yeah. But there's the appreciation of the grief, which is just a normal human expression of the loss of somebody that you love, you know. And then there's also a love for the beauty of grieving for somebody, you know. And then I think that.
Would be strange not to grieve.
And also it's an honor. It honors that person. If that person is somebody that you loved enough to grieve, that's an honor for that. There's something beautiful in it. So you're not making it into something that you're appreciating it for what it is without trying to.
I get it.
Yeah.
I think that was really a beautiful question he asked, because I also, like, when I first heard that, suddenly a bell went off, and I went, well, if you really held this belief that, you know, that I am Atma, and that everyone else is Atma, and therefore there is no death, the first thing that flashed in my mind was that nuclear scientist Oppenheimer, and I don't remember what he does quote from the Gita.
Well, you said something that I would kind of tweak on what something that you said there. You said, if you hold that belief. We're not talking about belief here.
Yeah.
We're talking about knowledge. If you're holding something like that as a belief, then that's like holding any other belief, like believing that there's a heaven or believing there's a hell or believing in this and believing in that. And, you know, whatever belief, religious belief is, it has some blessing for you or not. But that's not what we're doing here.
Well, or how can I say if you take it absolutely?
No.
Yeah.
No, if you know it.
If you know
it.
Yeah.
That's not taking it absolutely. It's not believing it.
Yeah.
It's understanding. It's actually seeing it.
But you know, it's like I don't know, but this is one of my polluted moments. It's just that I thought, like, so if that's true, and people are, all these delusions are running around grieving, then, you know, like someone might say, oh, the ultimate solution is destroy everything, you know, and then put them out of their grief because all there is.
Okay, let's not go there.
Yeah,
let's not go there.
Yeah.
That's too weird.
Yeah.
Right. Get it out there. What?
I was thinking, in order for it to be more than a belief, seeing the way you unfolded
changing from the state of consciousness to the dream state to the deep sleep state, and how that in and of itself doesn't break the deha and the body. One could say all of those states are still dependent upon the body and mind, and that so in order to really break it, it's necessary to recognize the fact that the body is constantly changing. That this, and you've done that before where you talk about it being made up of parts, and also talking about how it's, there's a sense that the body is, that I'm always this body, that it's always the same body. And so unless, there comes a point where unless I can see that this is never the same body, then I can't totally
Yeah, you know, there's different levels of approach here. Like, one is the recognition in your experience of that which is constant and that which is changing. That's a level of experiential recognition. Then you can go to the thing, well, that which is giving me the experience of that which is changeless could just be this physical body. Okay, so now we're going to a different approach, because now we have to look at the nature of the physical body itself, the nature of matter itself. Is there such a thing as matter? You know, so you're it's a natural logical progression for the mind to go to. First you'll say, well, yes, I see this subject object in a sense, or I can recognize the constant, but how do I know that the constant itself isn't the matter? Then we have to look at matter. By matter, I mean the physical body, and see if there is any such thing. Yeah. And then we go into that, looking at this as being infinitely divisible parts, and every single part of matter is something that comes into being and goes out of being, and is infinitely divisible, and in fact, you can't find anything apart from consciousness. So there's a lot of unfoldment around that, to see that there is no such thing as matter. That really, there's nothing here but consciousness. It has to resolve there, right? But before we can resolve that, first it's recognizing, differentiating the consciousness. So you even know what consciousness is, because consciousness is so identified with this individuality, this body. You know, but first we want to kind of weed it out a little bit. It's going back and forth from differentiating the consciousness from my experience to recognizing that there's nothing but consciousness here. First I have to differentiate the consciousness, and then I have to recognize there's nothing but consciousness. Because if I don't, but both things are necessary. If I can't differentiate the consciousness from the names and forms that I experience through my sense organs, then there's what we call a superimposition. And so consciousness and the object are taken as one of the same, and then we look out from there. So what has to happen is that everything has to be given to the creation, so that I can differentiate the consciousness from the creation. And then I have to recognize that this creation is nothing but consciousness. That's how I can end up with I am the whole. Right? But I can't end up with I am the whole if there's any identification with my being a part of the whole. Right? If I have an identification with any part of the consciousness, being this body or mind or sense organs or even the I thought, if I think there's a connection there, then I am existing within the whole. So that self has to be differentiated so I can recognize its timeless, changeless nature of me. And then I have to recognize that this me that I am is nothing but this, or that this is nothing but me. And that means that now I have to go back into this creation and try to find, to see it, to prove that there's nothing here but me. Make sense, kind of? And we go back and forth and back and forth.
You prove it and also recognize it, right?
Proving
it isn't enough. I mean,
you have to recognize it, yeah. But you also, you have to, that recognition also involves proof.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the proof, by proof, another word I can use is logical indefensible, that's the right word, understanding. Is that the right word?
Incontrovertible.
Incontrovertible. Yeah, there's another word I want, I can't think of it. Yeah, but there's an, yeah, undeniable is good, but there's something else. Indisputable. That's the word that I wanted. Thank you. The other words were fine, but that's the one that I was trying to find in my mind.
Even with, like, recognizing yourself is not the body, mind, sense organs, it's the same, too. I mean, there's all this logic and everything.
You have to see it, you have to be it, you have to recognize it, you have to understand it.
And you have to experience it also.
But part of the problem there is the experience is already there, so you have to recognize the experience. That's the problem, because we always think we have to experience it. The experience is already there, so we have to recognize. And that recognition involves differentiation. You might mean that, but there's a subtle difference in the word, because we always think about knowledge in terms of gaining knowledge, gaining an experience. And so you're going to gain an experience of yourself. And you're not going to gain an experience of yourself because the experience is already here. So that means it has to be differentiated, it has to be recognized. And then once you recognize it, then we have to see, what is this?
But is that, that's the same too, isn't it? In that to know that I'm the whole, it's actually a recognition, isn't it?
It is a recognition.
Yeah, already.
But the yes. It is. It is a recognition. But there's also, the mind requires more than recognition. It requires a recognition that is backed by indisputable logic. And by indisputable logic, I mean that your mind, as hard as it may try, can't dispute. It agrees. And it agrees because it understands. Mind has to understand. You could put it like this. The mind has to understand that it cannot be another way. And that's what makes it indisputable. Is that this is not optional. It's not, well, maybe it could be this way or that way. No, it can't be.
So, mean the mind has to understand that there's nothing else that all of this can be?
Yeah, that there's no other possibility. Yeah. Because somebody's saying, well, this is the only truth, and this is the truth, and this is not the truth. It's not about that. It's about logical impossibility. How something, like for instance, anvaya vyatireka. That's an example of a logic, right? It's an indisputable. Right. If this is and I am, and this is not, it goes away. It goes away, right? And I still am. Then I'm not connected to that thing. Right? So, because I exist with or without that. That's what I mean. That's what I mean by indisputable. And so there's so many things like that. That are indisputable, not because I'm right and you're wrong, it's because that's how it is. You just have to see clearly how it is. And then your mind says, oh, yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. So all those like that question about who is it that remembers that they have a good sleep at night. You're deeply asleep at night, and yet you remember, I slept deep.
Well, if you go into deep sleep, the mind is now in an unmanifest condition. It's called a sukshma vritti. That vritti is now being illumined by consciousness, but in that vritti, there's no activity. So now when that mind wakes up, there's activity, and its prior conditions are remembered. Whatever the prior, it'll remember dream conditions, if it does, That's a prior condition is remembered. The previous day, prior conditions are remembered. Deep sleep state, prior condition, that's remembered. And who is remembering it? The mind is remembering it, not the Atma. The Atma is just the constant there. The constant being. The constant awareful being, which is present to whatever the condition is.
So this proof you're talking about is for the mind, is for this human experience.
It's because the one who's having the trouble here is the mind. Right? The mind's the one that's suffering. And the mind is suffering because of ignorance. Because I don't know who I am. I don't know what this is. And so because of that, I'm behaving in the world in a way that is not true to the world. It's like beating your head against the wall. So this mind needs to gain knowledge. And get knowledge of myself. And knowledge of myself, knowledge of the creation, knowledge of God, knowledge of the whole. That knowledge requires a recognition of the reality that is right here. It's not the creation of a new reality or a new experience. It's a recognition of the reality that's right here. That requires knowledge. Knowledge requires seeing and understanding. Because there's a context. So you have to understand, so you have to see something and understand why it's that way. Your mind has to know. That's why you'll see something. So you get a vision of something. Say there's an unfoldment. And you see it. But then your mind says, yeah, but what about this and what about that? Right? So the mind needs to be clear. It has to understand. Not just see. It has to understand. Because that's the nature of the mind. Once it understands, then it doesn't have a question anymore. Because the question's been answered. But until the question has been answered, to the mind, to your mind's satisfaction, it'll keep asking, what about this and what about that? How could it be like that? How could it be like that? When it knows, it says, okay. Then it doesn't ask that anymore. So you find that process in terms of gaining knowledge, it's a continual process where the mind initially it'll be exposed to this knowledge, and it will have lots of questions, you know. And then, or if you don't have questions, the teacher will make sure will give you the questions. You know, but you'll have lots of questions. You'll ask the questions, and then there's questions, the teacher and whatnot, there'll be dialogue, and the questions will be answered, and you ask more questions, they'll be answered, more questions, they'll be answered. That goes on and on and on. And then at some point, certain questions will come into your own mind, and you'll answer them yourself. The question will come, and and you think through it, oh, that's what that is, and you answer it. And then that'll start happening more and more. The question comes, and you answer it. Question comes, you answer it. Question comes, and the answer comes. The question comes, the answer comes. And then after a while, the question-answer comes. The question-answer, like that. And then after a while, the question doesn't come because the answer is there. Right. That means that in that area, your mind is clear. Right, but it's only clear when it's clear. And somebody else can't make your mind clear. The teacher can teach and teach and teach, which is the pramana, right? But your mind is the one that has to question and question and see and see and see and question until your mind is the mind that will say, oh, okay, in that area, and then, oh, okay, in that area. And it becomes quiet in that area. You see how that process, you probably all see that working in yourself.
1918.
Yeah, not differently. So. Oh, you done?
Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Nice to be back.